Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. If you got our promotion, you know that this week's show is somewhat of a continuation from last week, in that I mentioned last week the eugenics movement. And I made some comments in terms of what that movement was and its impact marginally. I only talked about it very narrowly last week in terms of on education and the topic at hand then. After the show, got many requests from, I'm going to again assume, teachers wanting me to return to the issue of the eugenics movement and provide more depth information about what eugenics movement really was and how it impacts education. And back then, being the early 1900s, and to a considerable extent to today. So that's what today's show is going to be about, is the eugenics movement. I want to raise this question right off the bat. Before last week's show, how many of you had heard the term eugenics and eugenic movement? How many of you had some idea of what it was about? And how much information did you have about it? That would be very interesting to me, because I have found most people don't know the term, don't know the movement, don't know hardly anything about it. And so when you talk about eugenics, it's like a foreign language I'm speaking. And so that's one of the things. Also, educators, teachers, and parents as educators, but particular teachers, as I go through my comments on the eugenics movement, I want you to do something. I want you to do an analogy in the sense of saying, how does X, whatever I said X was, apply to me as a classroom teacher? Parent, same thing, but particularly teachers, because I'm going to describe what eugenics is about and some of its attributes, some of its ideas and all, and then I'm going to, in general terms, and then I'm going to apply the eugenics movement to education, and particularly in education, teachers, I want you to start thinking analogous, and I won't say any more because later on I'm going to point out exactly what the point that I want to make for this week's show. Okay, eugenics movement. You can go back as far as Plato. We're going back to the Greeks. If you remember the show that I did on racism and its origin, we started with the Greeks and Aristotle. Well, you can go back now to Plato and the Greeks, and his idea of classifying people. And the Romans, who pretty much followed behind the Greeks on a lot of things, their notion of classifying people. But particularly the Spartans, The Spartans, as you can recall from your world history, were a militaristic culture. And what they did was children, when they were born, in particular boys, they would set them out and see whether or not they could survive the weather, the conditions, without being nurtured, and et cetera. And if you didn't, you died. And if you did, you were considered to be proper stock to be a Spartan. So that's sort of like an amorphous beginning. Come forward by several thousand years, a couple thousand years, into, I mentioned last week, Darwin and his travels when he was classifying species and sampling plants and et cetera to get a notion of the how species have survived over long periods of time. Then I talked about the monk Mendelssohn and his study of peas. He was fascinated with the fact that some peas had smooth surfaces and others had dimpled or knotted sort of like surfaces, a crater-like surfaces, and he started doing his work. Both of these were, quote, the beginnings of science. Well, I'll say the beginning of the science, but they were using the scientific method. Hence, they were scientists seeking to gain knowledge and build a knowledge base upon which others could build on. Remember when I talked about the African-American Studies program and the fact that in the very beginning there was resistance to African-American Studies. People were saying it wasn't a discipline, it wasn't a science, and that a discipline is made up of a theoretical framework that may have multiple orientations within that framework that are theoretical in nature, but also a methodology, in that new knowledge is discovered through great theory set to research design, set to research and then outcomes analysis, and hence this is how we get to our truth. Well, Mendelssohn and Darwin were more in that vein of sciences. Fast forward, Darwin's cousin, Galton, got involved with the issue that I mentioned last week, in that in Europe and particularly in England, there was this recognition that the aristocracy, I guess you could say that period's 1%, was a very small population, and that they were not producing additions to their ranks in numbers great enough to ensure the survival of the aristocracy. Whereas the poor, the wretched, and others, they were reproducing like crazy. And so that there would come a time when the aristocracy would be wiped out because it failed to be able to reproduce itself. Now, in what I just said is the kernel of perhaps this whole idea of eugenics. The thought back then was that kings and queens and aristocracy, they were born with these qualities. They were innate, in that they were capable, qualities were capable of being passed along generation after generation because they were innate, and that certain segments of the population would have these superior attributes that were they were endowed with at birth, nature, whereas other segments of the population were not as generously endowed, and hence that everything was basically all of human behavior, all of human psychological attributes, emotional attributes, were all present at birth because they were biologically transmitted from parent to child. So like a predetermination is what I'm saying. Everything was predetermined in nature. And so Galton was interested in how can one help the aristocracy class survive? How can one help this group to continue to pass on its genetic endowment to future generations of its own kind, as opposed to being wiped out by future generations of classes of people who were not anywhere near genetically as endowed as the aristocracy? I hope I'm getting that over to you, because this is fundamental. And so that he starts doing his work, he's more or less maybe something like a mathematician as opposed to a science. And yes, math is considered a science now, but there's also this distinction between math, science, and science, or math and science per se. And so anyway, he starts this doing his research and coming up with ideas as to why certain people are not as genetically, when I say genetically endowed, I'm not talking about just physically, I'm talking about mentally and the notion of superiority and how he could help the aristocracy of his day to survive and thrive and have a very bright future going forward. So, in essence, what eugenics was, and then he gave this its name, eugenics, and the notion of biological determinism, maybe as a shorthand here, in that you and I, our parents, our grandparents, on throughout history, everything that we are, we were given at birth. I'm going to go back and say that again. Not only would say your hair color, your skin color, your eye color, the width of your nose, the thickness of your lips, your muscular structure, or what, your sex, was all predetermined, fixed, couldn't be changed. And that throughout a population, there would be a certain percentage of people who would have superior endowment. And that percentage would be small in comparison to that segment of the rest of the population that was not so genetically gifted or endowed at birth through the process of nature. Now, but there was something else, too, that was occurring at this time. He, Galton, looked at what farmers were doing with animals and crossbreeding animals. I think I mentioned last time the Doberman Pinscher was a crossbreed. You look at certain cattle, they're the results of crossbreeding. And so what he thought was, this was evident to him, that nature could be manipulated to some degree so that if you mated people with the right genetic makeup, then you could produce this hybrid, if you call it, or you could continue this strain of superior people just by selective breeding, is probably the best term I can use right now. And so that was his thing. He started this whole notion and research and ideology and et cetera. Now, in England, this was called positive eugenics. Positive in the sense that it was going to enhance mankind. It's going to somewhat ensure mankind's ability to perpetuate itself and have a better future. And by this selective breeding, you would guarantee that a certain population could grow. Now, when it came across the pond, the Atlantic, to the United States, it took a left turn. I remember I mentioned that same phrase. It took a left turn and headed in the direction of what was called negative eugenics. Here, it was a racist bonanza. It was a method that could be used to prove, quote, scientifically, what people had been arguing for in this country a couple hundred years, maybe close to 300 years or so, that white race was superior to the red, to the black, the brown, the yellow, and even some white as European from Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, and that if those populations that were inferior to the white race, that part of the white race, the European, the Western Europe, and the Nordic type, if there was a method to control the growth of the non-Western Nordic type, eventually that preferred group would be overtaken by hordes of inferior people. And that eugenics, as a quote, science, would provide the proof that they were right all along. And hence, eugenics went over like gangbusters in America. And let me also say this. When I say scientific, eugenics is considered pseudoscience. False. Just like we have what are now. Fake news, how about fake science? Alternative facts, how about eugenics? It was argued by some, just a few, that eugenics was not a science. It was a fraud. But yet and still, it was information that could be generated via this false science that would give people further justification for their notion of superiority and inferiority. When it was introduced, some of the most wealthy of individuals and organizations financially supported it. The Rockefeller Foundation, Kellogg, there's a whole list of them, and I'm like drawing a blank, but it was Carnegie was one of the main, Carnegie Foundation, it was one of the super main organizations that provide big, big money for, quote, research, propagation of this idea of eugenics as being the tool that would prove the point that there was this notion of inferiority and superiority. Some of, well, your president at the time, Theodore Roosevelt, was a very strong proponent of this. Einstein, the feminist Margaret Sanger, the founder, was it the chief founded parent? Help me out, folks. I can't think of parenthood or something. Anyway, and the notion of abortion. So this idea spreads like wildfire because it provided supposedly scientific data to support an ideology. I'm going to break for 1 second on that train of thought, and something that I think I said last week, but I'll say again this week. In sociology and social psychology. About the same time period, early 1900s, there are some social psychologists, sociologists, who were the founding fathers. And remember what I said before, I say founding fathers because women were not into academia, they weren't even allowed into academia, and of course they would not be recognized. So I'm saying founding fathers and the way in which it was developed and the way it was used. But one was a guy named W.I. Thomas, and the Thomas Theorem. And the Thomas Theorem goes something like this. What men define situations as real, they are real in their consequences. And what this theorem basically says is that if men define situation A as being real, whether it's real or not, it's the act of defining it as real. It becomes real in its consequences. If I say to you, if I'm a teacher or a parent, and I say to a student or my child, you're dumb, you're dumb, you're dumb, and then I act on that definition by treating you as if you're dumb. And hence, me defining you as dumb become real in terms of its consequences because I treat you that way. Then there was another theorist who took that concept, and the concept is called the definition of the situation that I just explained, and said, Robert K. Merton, sociologist, said the theorem was correct, but it was only partially developed. To fully develop this theorem, there's another component. And he came up with the idea of self-fulfilling prophecy. In that, again, if I define my students or a given student or a particular student as being bad, and I then treat this student as if he or she is bad, I create a structure whereby I produce a student that maybe wasn't bad to become bad. In other words, I create the conditions to turn a student that maybe was not bad, bad. So that student starts to act as a response to the way in which he or she is being perceived and being treated. And hence, if that person then starts acting, quote, bad, however we're going to define bad, then I can say, see, I was right. This person is bad. Here's the evidence. Now, take that into the classroom and you say dumb. When you say not smart, when you say marginally intelligent, when you say limited capabilities, and you start treating your students that way, and if others in the class treat students that way, if other teachers treat students that way, hence the students start acting, I can't do this, I don't understand this, I'm confused, I don't want to do this because I don't want to fail. You create those conditions to make the prophecy come true, make the prophecy self-fulfilling. This is what the eugenics movement in education really, really is about. So when I was saying last week that the situation in our schools today, in many instances, are very similar to the situation of our schools in the early 1900s to mid-1900s, even into the 2000s. Let me give you maybe a more concrete example of what I'm talking about. Eugenics, as related to education, and you tell me if you think I have this wrong, that eugenics was widely in education produced a model of education that was basically aimed at sorting students, situating students in the proper grouping, matching students based upon some preconceived or contrived set of presumptions. Is that what we do? Isn't that what we've been doing for decades, maybe a century? Is that we sort. We sort our students. Don't we? Then don't we set up situations where after we sort you in a group, then that group is oriented towards meeting the definition of how you were sorted? And is that, don't we match students based upon some preconceived or contrived set of presumptions? And all of this sorting, all of this matching, and everything that we do in education, is it based upon some notion of ability is innate? And that it's the job of education to successfully sort students and match them with vocations for which they are best suited? Now, I said a lot there, and I'm slowing down because I want what I said to soak in. That has been, and if those of you who maybe you took a history of education course in undergraduate or graduate school, maybe you also took a curriculum course in undergraduate, graduate school, think about it. Is that what we have been doing in education for the longest of time, this sort of matching, processing, and supposedly preparing students for their proper place in society sometime in the future? And isn't this all based upon something by matching the inborn ability that the child is given with, born with, and inborn ability with the appropriate path that society would consider best for that child, all based upon some notion of innate ability? When I say innate ability, we're saying something here that's given and can't be changed. This whole nature versus nurture, okay? If you take the nurture, then the possibilities are infinite in terms of how an individual can grow, can acquire knowledge, acquire skill. And basically, in terms of this argument, no limits on what you can learn, what you can do. I just had a thought in terms of when I was growing up, my mother used to always tell me, you can do anything that you want to do. You can be what you want to be. She wanted me to be a doctor, of course, but what she was saying was that you're smart. You can become X, Y, or Z. You're not dumb. The sky's the limit in terms of what you can do. And I can remember growing up, I would basically say, especially in my teenager in the early 20s and stuff like this, when I was doing things that people said I couldn't do, or not say me, the individual, but black people couldn't do, and what have you. I used to tell people, I specialize in doing what no one else has done before. And if there's someone who has done it before, I will do it faster, quicker, and better. Arrogance, yes. But that arrogance came from my parents telling me that I could do anything, I could be anything, and that my life was not fixed at birth. So when I'm in school and teachers would say, you can't do this, you can't do that, and I could. This is, I think, a very good example of how the eugenics movement worked its way into public education, but not only public education, but also into private education. At some point, eugenics was taught in high schools. It was taught in colleges. There was something like 200 and almost 300 college courses that had eugenics content in the 20s or 30s or 40s and 50s. Something like 20,000 plus students at the college level were exposed to the eugenics ideology, which was a racist ideology. And there was other aspects of eugenics. Let me go back now and back to eugenics. Take it out of education for a moment and put it back into the general public. In the eugenics movement, there were some principles here. They were saying that a large segment of the population was born inferior, and that unless that population was controlled, it would grow exponentially and overtake that segment of the population that was superior. And society, going back to the survival of the species, would not survive, would not be able to continue to achieve and to thrive, and especially Western civilization. By that time, Western civilization had pretty much started to conquer the whole world and all the various kinds of people, when I say kinds in terms of Asian, African, European, Southern Europeans, and et cetera. And if that was going to continue, something had to be done. And what the eugenics movement advocated for and got passed were laws. Remember, we're a nation of laws. And one of the many laws was that forced sterilization, forcing people to be sterilized so that they couldn't father or mother children. Force meaning against their will, without their knowledge. And there were 37 states that passed sterilization laws. From the time of the early 1900s to the 1970s, it was estimated over 64,000 forced sterilizations took place in this country, with California leading the charge. California rate of sterilization was insane. And matter of fact, either when I started Road Trip in 2015, or by sure 2016, it was discovered that in California, in the prisons, they were still sterilizing women. And they were saying that these women volunteered for sterilization. But through the investigation, it was determined that many of the women were not given an opportunity to say yes or no. Many of them were lied to so that they could be sterilized. And so go past 1970s and to today even. Marriage prohibition for people with physical and mentally disabilities. Criminals. Since, again, all behavior were, you were born with all of these behavioral traits. So criminality was not a situation where an individual find him or herself in a particular situation where they have to steal, like Les Miserables. I hope I just didn't mess it up. The Miserables. Great play. Man steals a loaf of bread to feed his family. He's a criminal. He did that because that was an innate trait. Criminality was an innate trait among certain level of the population. So criminality. The poor. If you are poor, you are poor because, again, you were born to be that way. And nothing was going to change that. If you were, quote, considered a degenerate, whatever way in which that was defined, you were to be sterilized. And then there was this notion that we're doing all of this back in America, we're doing all of this to conserve the nation's racial stock, the white, Nordic, Western Europe, Anglo-Saxon. So, you get this back to education. So we have now these ideas. They say they're scientifically derived. We have, quote, I say we, the eugenics produces their data, and which brings me to where we are to somewhat today. Data. All of these arguments for sterilizing people, looking at people as immutable, degenerates, and that they were all born with these undesirable traits that if not dealt with would overrun society. Eugenics provided this, quote, scientific data. And with that data in hand, the laws that I just mentioned, and the notion that we must spread this knowledge, we must spread this information so that current and future generations will understand what's going on, will be supportive of it, was all based upon providing data to back up the ideas of or principles of the eugenic movement. Going directly back to education, and here's what I said earlier, I want teachers to be listening to what I was saying and to do an analogy. The premise for this show, and when I mentioned it last week, is that teachers, you are the victims of leftover eugenics movement. You are being sorted. Good teacher, bad teacher, need improvement. You're being assessed by people oftentimes who've never been a teacher, never been a classroom. They're using a rubric. And they are, I will say, arbitrarily, in some many cases, measuring you based upon this rubric. Especially, what was that, 4 or 5 years ago when it started to become really, really obvious what was happening to teachers as a result of No Child Left Behind and then Race to the Top when Bush administration came up with the four routes to privatizing schools and this notion of teacher evaluation, VAM, value added measure, and then its use as if it was scientific proof positive and careers were being shattered, lives were being shattered. To me, what is happening to teachers today is a direct response to what took place, started its genesis in the early 1900s, and we are operating under some of those same conditions and principles but now it's the teachers who are being eugenicized. I just made that word up, and not the students. Teachers use as instruments to eugenicize students. Now they are being eugenicized themselves. Go back again, if you are in your 40s, maybe 50s, maybe even to your 30s, late 30s, and on. Back in the day, eugenic labels and practices of the past was that you would categorize people either as feeble-minded, imbeciles, morons, unfit, idiots, mongrels. These were rampant and detrimental terms and practices visited upon students back in the day. These were malicious by all, I won't say that, let me stop, because I said malicious. That's a judgment. In my view, these were malicious. They were political. They're theological components of a larger ideology that was aimed at one purpose among and above all else, that is to prove the superiority of one group of people over other groups. And thus, in my view, makes it malicious. And these labels, these practices, were also designed to perpetuate the inequalities that existed then and even exist in education today on a daily basis. Presently, we use labels and practices such as at-risk, at-risk population, at-risk students. We have special needs, not ordinary needs, but special needs. We have no child left behind, meaning what? We've been leaving kids behind, and these kids are not getting an adequate break. Why have we been leaving kids behind? I'm going to stop this practice of leaving kids behind by putting in this program called No Child Left Behind. What does that say about the kids who are left behind? Why were they left behind? How were they left behind? And by whom? Ability tracking. Boy, that's something that we do from now preschool going forward, is ability tracking of students. We are so steeped in the mechanisms of measurement, testing. We are so dependent on, quote, IQ exams. We sort kids by gifted, talented, versus you're not gifted, you're not talented. So what are you, like average or something, borderline stupid or what have you? But we do that. And teachers are the instruments to which these practices are promulgated. That's teacher's job, is that you help identify, classify, sort, situate, assess students so they could be properly categorized. Curriculum. And as I mentioned earlier, boy, you know, we've used the curriculum from day one as a weapon to socialize today's youth, children and youth, to be tomorrow's conforming, compliant young adults. And if you don't see your curriculum that you went through as a student from kindergarten to 12th grade, freshman to graduate school, this is what curriculum is all about, folks, is socializing you for a predetermined kind of future. And I've mentioned this several times on the show, but for today, on day being this period in terms of where we are now, when I talked about, I think it was a little over a year ago, the notion of remaking of humanity and for a future that is yet to come. And I don't want to go too far in because I'm going to do a whole series of shows on education and technology that Emily Talmadge brought to our attention, Allison Hewitt brought to our attention, and a few others. But it's through curriculum that all of these things that we've talked about is brought through. Now, so we have this thing in terms of nature versus nurture. Are we fixed at birth, or through nurturing we can grow and develop uninhibitedly, infinite possibilities, maybe, you know, limited to some extent in terms of what you're capable of becoming and all. Now, teachers. The rest of what I'm going to say is directly pointed to teachers. Aren't you being, and since, as I said earlier, since No Child Left Behind, and even before that, going back to the 80s and Reagan and A Nation at Risk, when the schools were being blamed for this massive failure of schools, massive failure of educating students properly and making students capable of being competitive in a global economy. Remember that? A Nation at Risk, and that famous statement there, that if what was happening to our schools was being the result of a foreign agent or entity, it would be considered act of war, that our schools were being warred upon by a foreign entity. Our teachers incompetent, our administrators incompetent were such that we were putting this nation at risk. If you start there, and I have gone back further, of course, to Sputnik, but if you start there and come forward every decade, and you're at a point now where teachers, you, as I mentioned earlier, you are the students now who are being looked at as guinea pigs. You're being trained in school prep, ed prep programs to be able to go out and become test meisters. You're being trained to the curriculums, No Child Left Behind, Common Core, whatever, to be able to efficiently utilize the curriculum to further narrow the training of the students so that they will be more specifically prepared to do specific jobs in the future. And if you don't meet certain standards, you're sorted. You're sorted into being great, being marginal, need improvement, need dismissing. You are evaluated through VAM. And by the way, VAM came about through, and I'm laughing here because when I mentioned, maybe I didn't mention, that the American Breeders Association and Breeders Association in Europe, when I mentioned that they were crossbreeding animals and getting different species of animals, they were relied upon here in this country to help push the legislation to establish the eugenic laws and principles, the sterilization, the testing, and the classifications, and et cetera. And I'll say this, and I keep saying this. Now that I mentioned some of the things, the aspects of eugenics that I've had, can you see any comparison between what is happening to you today and what was happening to students also today, but yesterday? You are being pushed to fit a mold. The teachers that can get, quote, the high test scores versus the teachers who can't. And I know you know teachers who have been teaching for 10, 15, 20 years, considered great teachers, all of a sudden, under the new VAM and other measurements, you need improvement. And you're given a year or 2 years. If you don't improve, you're out. What are you improving on? You're improving on the metrics of the eugenic leftover movement. This is why I wanted to come back to this subject today. I don't know whether or not I succeeded in terms of getting you to see yourself as being the victim of the eugenic movement, of something that started back in 1909, 1907 here in the United States and a little earlier in Europe, and has been in practice in one form or another, has evolved in different types of practices and labels that have been foisted on kids for decades. Now it's your turn. Now it would be my turn if I was still teaching at the university. We are the new eugenics target of our generation, of our period. We're doing what's being done to us now has been done, we've been doing to kids for, as I said, a very long, long time. And you have to understand this, teachers, in my opinion, if you're going to have any shot at turning the tables. You have to be aware, you know, that paradigm that we use here, being aware, understanding, emotionally engaged in the issue, the individual or collective action. If this doesn't get you through this paradigm to the point where you're not emotionally engaged, I don't know what else will. Because as I've been saying for the last 3 years, what's happening to you is not by accident. What's happening to you is by design. And I say you because, again, I'm not in the classroom anymore. So those who are in the classroom, be it elementary, middle school, high school, college, what's happening is to weed you out. Those who cannot produce the test scores, and test scores are just, to me, a symbol of saying that you are producing students who, if they continue through our process, will be the kinds of young adults that will come out and perform and provide a service that's in our best interest, not your best interest, Mr. and Mrs. Student. Teachers, you're playing a crucial role in this, and it's what I used to call thinning of the herd. You know, when the government gives people hunters license to even get in helicopters, fly over a herd of wild horses, and shoot and kill so many of them because there's too many wild horses for that area. You are that herd now. And the eugenics movement and all of its principles are being applied to thin out our herd of teachers. Now, I said a lot of things. Some people may take offense to it. I say what I consider to be my truth. And if it doesn't satisfy you or if it pisses you off, so be it. But if you think about it, and you understand eugenics, as I've laid it out, and there's a lot more that you can go out on your own and read about, I think a lot of you are going to say, you know what? I'm being eugenicized. I see it now. It's what was happening to my students. It's what I'm being forced to do now, to eugenicize them, because I'm being eugenicized in the process. So, think about it. It'd be nice to hear from someone in terms of going to a Facebook page and let me know what you think about what I have to say. Our time is up, folks. Thank you. See you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.